the Birth Trauma Mama podcast. I'm your host, Kaylee Summers, a licensed therapist and birth trauma survivor. This is a space where we talk about what it means to experience trauma during a time that we expected to be one of the best of our lives. The stuff is dark and it's messy, but we're here to shine a light on it. We're here to hold your hand as you walk through the darkness. We're here to show you that the light exists, and we're going to help you find it. So wherever you are, take a deep breath, settle in, and let's do this. Welcome to the first ever episode of the Birth Trauma Mama podcast. I am so excited that you're here and equally sad to know what likely brought you here listening to a podcast about birth trauma. I hope this space provides you with support and comfort and community while also allowing you to laugh and find joy in a time that created so much uncertainty and devastation. I have some really exciting episodes planned with some truly incredible individuals in this space. And for today, I thought we would start with how the heck I ended up here, recording a podcast about birth trauma, shouting from the rooftops that it is okay if the day your baby was born was also one of the worst days of your life. Because 3 years ago at this time, I was 37 weeks pregnant. We had just moved into a brand new house at our boarding school. And you could never in a million years have convinced me that I would spend the next 3 years of my life talking about birth trauma. Birth trauma was not even on my radar. Even as a therapist, I had no idea that individuals were coming out of their birthing experiences traumatized. I knew about complications. I was concerned about complications. But I didn't consider the emotional impact that complications could have on someone who was birthing their child. I honestly just viewed it as like, I gotta get through this. Because in the back of my mind, I was very concerned about having a big baby, about complications, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just viewed this as, let's just get through this. Let's get the baby out. Let's everyone be safe. And I had no clue the implications that a traumatic birth could have on me and my entire family. So just a quick reminder before I get into sharing about how I got here and a little bit about my birth story. Birth trauma is subjective. You get to decide whether your birth was traumatic for you. There is a wide variety of birth trauma that exists. So just because your birth trauma doesn't look like someone else's doesn't mean that it's not valid. All of our trauma is going to look different depending on what happened in our birth, what stuff we bring into our birth already, and how we cope overall. And birth trauma isn't caused by just one specific thing, unfortunately. It can be caused by severe life-threatening complications. It can also be caused by really poor treatment and obstetric violence. So again, as you're hearing these stories, as you're listening to this podcast, please know that everything is not going to look the same or feel the same. And that's okay because our trauma is unique, just as we as human beings are unique. The irony of this story and of me telling this story is that it begins just as my memory completely gives out. I suffered retrograde amnesia from my birth trauma. So the story that I'm about to tell you is pieced together from text messages, medical records, and other people's experiences during my birth. I don't have a single memory of 9 full days, both before, during, and shortly after my son's birth. Cal's birth story starts at 40 weeks and 2 days. I had some high blood pressure readings, so they sent me into the hospital as per protocol. And after many discussions with my doctors and weighing the pros and cons, we decided that induction was the best course of action at that point. So I had a few days of induction interventions, and on the 3rd day, I was 10 centimeters. My OB came in to talk me through what pushing would look like, had practice with my nurse first, and then she would be right back and we would start pushing for real. I was really anxious, and she was great about getting me excited to meet my baby and reminding me that this was the last step and that I could do it. So she left the room. It was me, my husband, and my nurse in the room. And I turned to my nurse and I said, I'm not feeling well. And she said, yeah, that's normal for transition, but let me get you a bag to be sick in. As she was doing that, I said, no, something is really wrong. And she turned towards the monitors to check out what was going on. And as she did that, I started screaming that something was wrong with my heart. I immediately collapsed. I went into cardiopulmonary arrest. So my heart stopped and I stopped breathing. My husband ran out into the hallway and screamed for a doctor. My nurse hit the code blue alarm. Code blue 230 rang out throughout the entire hospital. And everyone came running. My room flooded with multiple medical professionals, all trying to help save our lives. They got me to the OR. They got Callahan delivered within 6 minutes of my code. He was not okay at first, but he was able to be resuscitated very quickly and was taken straight to the NICU. At that point, they were still performing CPR. After about 9 or 10 minutes, they were able to resuscitate me. And from there, it was pretty much hours and hours of trying to keep me alive. Once they resuscitated me, I went into what's called DIC, which is basically where your body clots in these little clots everywhere that it's not supposed to, consumes all of your clotting factors, so then you rapidly bleed out. And so by the end of this ordeal, I needed more than 140 units of blood product. And my team at this point had recognized, thankfully, that I was likely suffering from an amniotic fluid embolism. And they had made the call for ECMO because although they did resuscitate me, my heart and lungs weren't recovering in a way that would actually sustain life. So they needed to get me on ECMO, which is the highest form of life support, so that it could do the job of my heart and lungs and keep me alive long enough so that my heart and lungs could recover. So while they were waiting for ECMO to be transferred in, I was continuing to bleed out. They were doing everything in their power to stop the bleeding. They put in a Bakri balloon. They tried to embolize my uterine arteries, but nothing was working. And my heart stopped again. I coded again. CPR again had to be initiated. And I was thankfully again resuscitated after another few minutes. And at this point, they decided they were going to have to do a hysterectomy. And they had continued to keep my family up to date to the best of their ability. Unfortunately, those updates were hard because a lot of them were, she's in critical condition. We don't know what else we can do. We're trying everything we can to save her, but she keeps bleeding. Please pray was one of the updates. And so my family was left thinking that I was not going to make it out of this alive. Thankfully, at this point, they knew that Callahan was okay and that he would be okay. So they felt like they didn't have to worry about him as much as they were worrying about me. So my team was able to get me on ECMO. They were able to do the hysterectomy as well as pack my entire abdominal cavity and leave me open with a wound vac because they assumed they were going to have to go back in. About 8 hours later, so this happened around noon, and by like 8 p.m., they were trying to get me transferred to the facility that could maintain the ECMO circuit. So before I was transferred to the medical center, but after my hysterectomy and my exploratory laparotomy, my trauma surgeons and the head of OB came to update my family on my status and my prognosis moving forward. They were encouraged that I had made it through the past 8 hours and that I was able to be transferred, but they were unsure what my prognosis looked like moving forward, given the extended cardiac arrest and the fact that I was on ECMO. So at this point, my family had hoped that I might not die. They just weren't sure exactly what the outcome was going to be. And so they did tell them that they were going to be able to see me on my way to be transported to the hospital if they wanted to. So my family waited in the hallway, right at the exit before I was being taken. And they warned them that I would not look like myself, that I would look even bigger than I was when I was pregnant because of all of the fluid. And so they rolled me up. There was about 10 or 12 medical professionals behind my bed. And Steve was the first one to come over to me. And the rest of my family says they will never forget that moment because there was not a dry eye in any of the medical professionals. Steve just leaned in. He told me that he loved me and that Callahan was perfect and that I had done a really good job. And he let me know that I just needed to fight a little bit longer. And the rest of my family said hi and bye to me and let me know that they would be on the other side of the other hospital waiting for me to get there.
I was transferred to the medical center's CTICU, their cardiothoracic ICU, on ECMO and on a ventilator. At this point, ECMO was keeping me alive. It was doing the job of my heart and my lungs, but my heart was not recovering in a way that would sustain life after I was taken off of ECMO. They had tried every sort of medication to get it to start pumping effectively, but none of those medications were working. And I was at risk for a massive clot in my left ventricle, which would kill me. So their last-ditch effort was the Impella, which is this tiny little windmill device. It's like a little, it's the smallest heart pump. They put it up through your femoral artery into your heart. It expels the blood. It gives your heart a chance to rest and recover so that hopefully it can go back to being an effective organ that actually keeps you alive. Thankfully, that was the case for me. So after 24 hours of the Impella being in, my heart was working as it should have been. And after 2 days of being on ECMO, I was able to come off. After 3 days of being on the ventilator, I was able to come off. After 4 more abdominal surgeries in 4 days, they were able to close me. And on the 5th day, I was able to meet my son Callahan for the first time. I wish that I could tell you what it was like to meet him for the first time, but I actually don't remember. Thankfully, my family did take a video, so I have that to look back on. I don't remember the first couple of days awake, but apparently I was very confused, as you can imagine. The last thing I remembered was being 9 months pregnant, and then I'm in a hospital with all of these machines around me. I assumed that I had been in a car accident, and I think that's just because every show that I've ever watched, when someone has no idea what happened and they wake up from a coma, I feel like it's typically a car accident. So unfortunately I was very confused at first, and I thought because Steve wasn't in the room in this certain instance, and Cal obviously wasn't in the room because he was up in, the baby boarding unit. I thought that they had both died in the car accident. So my mom was very quick to get Steve in the room and show me pictures of Cal, and they explained to me that I had a C-section with complications, which is putting it lightly, but they didn't know how to tell me what had happened. And so thankfully the next day, which is the first memory that I have, my OB and my anesthesiologist from my original hospital that ran the code and saved our lives came and explained to me everything that happened. And I will forever be grateful that they did that, because I am someone who thrives on information and need to know exactly what happened to me, especially in a situation like this where so much had happened and I had none of that information. So they sat with me, they held my hands, and they told me every single thing that my body had gone through, in a more general way, as to obviously not overwhelm someone who is still sick and somewhat sedated. And I do have a memory of that conversation, so I can tell you my thoughts and feelings when I heard exactly what had happened. And I remember feeling like, okay, this fits together. Like, this makes sense as to why not only am I in a hospital, but I have all of this intense machinery around me. I have all kinds of tubes and lines coming out of my body. Like, these puzzle pieces fit together. And I remember thinking like, okay, I just kept saying, okay, okay. And I got really tired, and I remember thinking, please don't stop telling me what happened to me, but I also need to close my eyes. And I actually said that out loud to my OB. I was like, this is not too much for me. I want to know every piece of information. I just can't focus on you because I'm so tired and my eyes are so heavy. So I'm going to close my eyes, but can you please keep talking? And she did. And I kept saying, okay, okay. And then she got to the point where she said, Keely, we did everything we could think of, but we couldn't save your uterus, and we had to do a hysterectomy. And then I just started
crying. It still gets me choked up to think about, because I just remember I was like, okay, I'm here. I'm alive. Like, they saved me. This sounds really intense. I have no idea what they're talking about, but whoa, that sounds crazy. And I'm here. And then she said that we had to do a hysterectomy. And I just remember my heart dropped because, you know, I wanted more than one baby and it was heartbreaking. And then I remember, like, okay, but that's okay because you're here. I like immediately went to what I talk about with the toxic positivity. But honestly, in that moment, it was necessary, right? I have all of this information and I can't even cope with any of it. And so I need to sort of prioritize it and focus on, like, okay, I'm still in the CTICU. I need to get healthy. I need to get better. And then we can, like, focus on all of the awful things that have happened to me. And from there, it was really a focus on my recovery. Originally, when this first happened, the medical team told my family that I would likely be in the hospital for like a month, and then I would transfer out to a rehab facility. They didn't expect such a quick turnaround with the Impella and coming off of ECMO. So I actually was only in, I was in the ICU for 2 weeks, and then I discharged straight to home. So I got to skip rehab, which was my goal all along. And I recovered much more quickly than they expected, which obviously was a good thing. I wanted out of that ICU as quickly as possible. The care was amazing. The experience was absolutely miserable. For anyone who's been in the ICU, I think you can understand, especially once you become a lot more aware in the ICU. So the last week that I spent in the ICU, I was very aware, very conscious, and I was incredibly anxious. I just couldn't fall asleep because I was afraid if I fell asleep, I wouldn't wake up, for obvious reasons. The main thing that got me through all of this anxiety and lack of sleep was my family, my support system. My mom and my husband, Steve, switched off nights sleeping with me in the ICU because I really couldn't be alone at that point. Lots of family and friends came to visit because this was pre-COVID and kept me company, kept me preoccupied so that I wouldn't think about the pain and the anxiety that I was experiencing at that point. Cal did stay in the hospital as long as I was in the hospital, which was amazing because he was able to come visit. And we had some really amazing baby nurses who would come and sit with me for hours so that Cal could stay for hours rather than just a quick 15-minute visit. So I'm very, very grateful to them. And then after 2 weeks, I was discharged and I was so excited to be going home instead of anywhere else, but I was still really sick. And I think that part was difficult for me because, and I think a lot of people in this space understand this feeling of anxiety. You want so badly to get out of the hospital and be home with your baby. And you're also terrified to not be monitored 24/7 after almost dying. So there was a lot of anxiety along with the excitement of returning home. And that was before I realized what the heck going home was going to entail emotionally. Because I assumed when you have a near-death experience and you make it out alive, it becomes this second chance at life. This wonderful, magical rebirth, if you will. And I assumed that me, my husband, and my baby, we're going to go home and live happily ever after. Because so many medical professionals came into my room and told me I was a miracle and told me it was amazing that I was still here and they couldn't believe it. And they felt like they were looking at a ghost, especially the medical professionals who were a part of the original code. They were crying. They were so happy to see me alive. And so I really thought that this was going to be a magic fairy tale ending and we would ride off in the sunset, the three of us, and just live the happiest, most joy-filled life. Enter birth trauma. When we first returned home, I was still pretty sick. I was sleeping 14-hour days. A home health nurse had to come and pack my incision every day and take my blood pressure because my blood pressure was still high and my incision hadn't closed since they left me open for so long and there was so much trauma to the area. And so at this point, I could not take care of Callahan at all by myself. So my parents actually stayed with us for the first 6 weeks of Cal's life to help us take care of him and take care of me, honestly, at that point. And that was incredibly helpful. We are so grateful that they were willing to do that. And also, it was really, really hard on our family dynamic because here I am, supposed to be a new mom taking care of my newborn, and instead, I'm basically a daughter again, being taken care of by my parents and my husband. And it was just an absolute crapshoot. Not to mention the fact that everyone staying in that house was traumatized. My parents were there when the code blue was called. They heard the code blue from my room. They were traumatized. My husband was traumatized. And I was clearly traumatized. So just a fun little trauma soup happening in the first like 6 weeks postpartum. While I was swimming in this lovely trauma soup, I remember having these two conflicting feelings, which were on one hand, I was absolutely devastated as I watched everyone give Cal his first bath and change his diapers and feed him and snuggle him. All the things that I wasn't able to do. I could barely stand up for more than a few minutes, let alone hold Cal at that time. And so I remember just sitting there and crying about all the things that I couldn't do. But then on the flip side, I remember when people would ask me like, oh, do you want to feed Cal? I would be like, absolutely effing not inside my brain. And typically I would just like paste on a smile and do it anyway. And it was like painful to do because both physically, I was constantly exhausted. I had no energy. I couldn't do anything except sit there. Like just sitting there on the couch took all of my energy. So someone wanting me to feed the baby was like, I can't do that. And I remember dreading whenever anyone would ask me to feed him. He was on formula, so we're talking bottle feeding. And then there was this other layer of my husband and my family wanting me to like want to be involved or like wanting to include me. And so if I said no to feeding the baby, they would be all worried about me. And it was just this awful back and forth. And so what I really wanted is to feel good enough to want to feed my own baby, right? I didn't want to because I didn't feel good. And that internal struggle for me was so, so difficult. And these opposing conflicting feelings only intensified and became more and more complicated. There was a lot of sitting around trying to heal. So again, a lot of time for me to think and think and think. And I had a lot of feelings around like, why did this happen to me? Why can't I just have a baby and leave the hospital? How did this happen? I was healthy. A lot of like, why me? Why am I sitting here on this couch not able to take care of my baby? And then the onslaught of how dare you when so many others haven't made it out of this alive? How dare you have a second of grief or anger or why me and whining? And how dare you, given everything that everyone did to save your life so that you could be here? I was so hard on myself and so judgmental of the thoughts and feelings I was having towards my birthing experience. And I think I would have struggled with this for a lot longer had I not gotten into therapy so quickly. So the one thing that I will say being a therapist was helpful for was that when I was released from the hospital, even though I was like, yeah, we're going to have the best life ever, second chance, blah, 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 rainbows and butterflies, there was also a little therapist voice in the back of my head going, hey, what you just went through was crazy AF. You're going to struggle at some point. You should just like get into therapy now. And so I did. In doing that, getting into therapy with someone who specializes in perinatal mental health was really, really important for my recovery because she was able to challenge a lot of the judgment and self-sabotage that I was participating in after my traumatic birth experience. I also want to be clear that I didn't go into therapy and all of a sudden everything was magic and perfect because I entered into my therapist's office. It was a long struggle. And if you follow me, if you've heard me talk on this, you know that I wasn't just automatically healed after a couple of weeks of therapy. And that's really the part that I want to focus on in this podcast. Everyone always wants to hear the birth story, and I, of course, will share that. But where the real story is for me and where the growth has been and where like the important, like the meat of this issue is the postpartum, is the after, and how we recover and how we heal from birth trauma. Because the first line of defense is always going to be prevention. Preventing birth trauma will always be the first goal. But unfortunately, not all birth trauma is preventable. And so if we only focus on that, if we say this is the way to stop birth trauma from happening, this is the way to fix birth trauma, and we only focus on that, what we say to the people who still end up traumatized is, this was your fault. If all birth trauma is preventable, this is your fault because you didn't do the things to prevent it. And that's how we quote unquote fix birth trauma. And that's just not true, right? There will unfortunately always be birth trauma that happens because of unpreventable situations. And that is not and never will be the fault of the birthing individual. Nor is any birth trauma, preventable or unpreventable, ever the fault of the individual who ends up traumatized. Which brings us to the after piece, the recovery, the healing, the making our way through the mess that birth trauma leaves us with. And for me, that looked like therapy, but it also looked like medication. I developed postpartum depression in response to my birth trauma, and medication was massively helpful for me. The first 6 months of my postpartum were horrendous. I cried every day. I didn't know how I was going to survive this. It felt like our marriage was falling apart on top of it. Again, we were swimming in that trauma soup, and I wasn't sure how I was going to get my life back because it felt so much like my life was lost. The person I was before no longer existed. I was an absolute shell of myself, and I did not see a light at the end of the tunnel. I did not see how this could ever get better. It just felt like who I was now. Right? I had a baby. I had this big monumentous event. And then after it, I was this new person. And so for me, it made sense that like, this is just who I am now. This is never going to change. This is a result of having a baby and having birth trauma. And that was absolutely terrifying to me. And it took my therapist reminding me that this is not who I was. This was just who I was working through trauma. And I wouldn't feel this way forever. And I did not believe her. I didn't. Until I got there. And little by little, through working with her, through medication, through support, through community, I started to find my way. And that probably happened around like 8 or 9 months. And then I got hit in the face with the first birthday, which is an episode all on its own. So I'll save that for a later episode. But for me, there was never like a light switch moment like I anticipated. I anticipated that one day I would just wake up and everything would feel better. Everything would feel normal. I would feel like my old self. And that's not how healing works, as I quickly found out. It's incremental. It's little by little. You start to build yourself back up. And you don't build yourself up into the person that you were before. trauma changes us forever. But you build yourself into something that is beautiful and that you do love. And it's also different than it was before, which can be difficult to accept. That acceptance of the fact that life will never be the same after trauma takes a while. And it's scary to consider before we're ready to consider it. I was like, you will take me kicking and screaming before I accept that I can't get my old life back. And for the first few months, I wished and I hoped and I begged for my old life back. And that's okay. And that's normal. That's a normal part of the process that we have to go through in terms of trauma and grieving our old lives. But eventually we get to a place where we accept that it will be different and also that a different life can still be okay. And that's when we start to experience post-traumatic growth, is through our acceptance of our trauma being life-changing, but also that life after trauma can still be really good and full and beautiful. One of my biggest hurdles in order to get to this feeling of accepting and moving through the trauma healing was around my thoughts and feelings. And I talked about earlier how I was so hard and judgmental on my thoughts and feelings towards my birthing experience. I believed that I could be nothing but grateful because I had this complication happen that has a high, high mortality rate. And even after I recovered, a few weeks later, a woman the same age as me, in a really good hospital, all of these things didn't make it. And so that solidified for me that gratitude was the only option, because there are other moms that have experienced AFEs that haven't made it home to their babies. So there is no room for anger or sadness or grief or just anything negative. What I didn't realize I was doing to myself at that point was completely robbing myself of any sort of healing, because we cannot heal if we don't feel. So by not allowing myself to have the emotions that were coming up for me around my birthing experience, I was robbing myself and my family, my newborn, of my healing. As soon as I learned that my anger and my sadness don't negate my gratitude and my absolute joy that I get to be alive raising my son, as soon as I realized that those two things were not mutually exclusive, it was like this huge weight lifted off my shoulders. And that is really where I saw sort of a turning of the corner in my healing. And when I started to really feel like I could make progress because I could actually express the things that I was feeling out loud without judging myself and without correcting those feelings, without snuffing them out with gratitude. And for so long in my postpartum, there was, you know, the story, right? The story is that Kaylee should have died and she didn't, and therefore she's a miracle. And when a miracle happens, like, the only thing you are is grateful. And that's the story that I told myself. And I had to pull back that story, and I had to recognize that that's only one small side of the story. That story doesn't describe the loss that happened. The loss of my ability to have more kids, the loss of my bonding with my son, the loss of my memory, right? Of being able to remember any piece of labor. I do not remember a single part of labor, and I'll never have another labor again. I don't remember meeting my son for the first time. I don't remember the first 5 days of his life. Every single person in my family and who came to visit me met my son before me. There is such loss in my story, and yet all I was able to focus on was the fact that I barely made it out alive. And that's not to negate the importance of that, of course, but it's also to remind us that that feeling of gratitude can coexist with feelings of anger and sadness and grief. And just because you made it out of your birth alive and your baby alive, while those are wonderful things, that bar is so gosh darn low if that's our only expectation of our birthing experience. You're allowed to be upset and let down and grieving because of things that you did not get to experience in your labor and delivery due to a traumatic birth. You get to take up space with those feelings. And once I learned that, once I started taking up that space unapologetically, that is when I finally started to heal. And as I began to heal, when the fog of birth trauma started to lift, I looked around and I realized we weren't talking about this. Not many people were discussing birth trauma. And as a therapist, I thought to myself, like, what can I do? How can I use my skill set as a therapist to help others who have been and will be in the position that I was in? Because although I had the amazing AFE Foundation, who gave me so much support and gives their survivors and their grieving families so much support, I also still felt so alone. Like, no one was talking about these feelings that come up. No one was talking about how hating the day your baby was born is okay, because it doesn't mean you hate your baby. And I was like, someone needs to tell people that that's okay. And that's where my Instagram sort of developed. And it's been about 2.5 years since I started that page. And the amount of amazing individuals I have met through this space, I cannot count. It's been so wonderful to be a witness to so much healing and such power in individuals choosing to take back their stories and their lives through their healing. And my hope for this podcast is to continue that healing, to create a space full of community and support and comfort as you navigate your life after birth trauma. I hope that as you listen to these episodes, you feel validated and loved and supported. I hope that you learn to feel unapologetically and to show up for yourself and your healing, because you deserve to take up space and your birth trauma deserves healing. There's such a wealth of knowledge and information out there, and I hope to be able to bring that to you. I hope that in this space, we can continue to heal together. I've shared parts of my story, and it doesn't even scratch the surface of birth trauma. We haven't talked about bonding after birth trauma, relationships after birth trauma, sense of self after birth trauma. There is still so much to uncover. And so I hope that you will join me as I continue to heal and as I shout from the rooftops that it is okay if you are not okay with the way that your birth unfolded. Because none of us asked for this. None of us asked to leave our births with a suitcase full of trauma that we would have to wade through for the rest of our lives. We didn't ask to be traumatized by the birth of our baby. But here we are, listening to a podcast about birth trauma. But if there's one thing I know, and if there's one thing I've learned on this adventure, it's that this healing work is a heck of a lot easier to do with a community than it is on your own. Thank you so much for stopping by. I am really looking forward to these conversations on birth trauma, and I'm hopeful that we can slowly start to unpack those suitcases full of trauma that we've so expertly stuffed at the back of our closets.